Sandy in Kansas, you're on the air. Thanks for holding.
Hello, Alex. I'm a first-time caller. I'm a huge fan. I love your work.
I love you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Knowledge Fight. I'm Dan.
I'm Jordan.
We're a couple dudes like to sit around, drink novelty beverages, and talk a little bit about Alex Jones.
Indeed we are, Dan.
Jordan.
Dan?
Jordan.
I think everybody is clamoring for Plant Watch updates.
Plant Watch.
July 11th, 12th, and whatever day it is today. What are we doing plant-wise?
Plant-wise, we're in a bit of a holding state right now, a little bit of a holding pattern. All the peppers are coming in well, but none are fruiting yet. There's, you know, we got the serranos and the Thai chili plants. Those were the ones that were planted first.
Right.
And they've come, you can see them. They're about, you know, they're over a foot tall.
Yeah.
Now.
I was wondering.
They're coming in quite well.
Yeah.
But still not fruiting. So we'll see what happens there.
When are they supposed to fruit?
I don't know. I think probably by now. This is my first rodeo with, having a bunch of plants. So I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
But then the second round of peppers, the Trinidad scorpions and the chocolate bootlas.
Okay.
They're coming in. They're coming in quite well. I was a little bit worried about them. They were a little stubby, and I thought that I'd messed everything up, but they're coming in nice. They're still probably in the 4, 5, 6 inch height range.
And those are the ones that you can't touch with your hands, otherwise you'll die.
Well, you can.
Yeah, but...
Maybe just don't then rub your eyes or something.
Right.
That's the same thing with like jalapenos even. Like if you cut some jalapenos up and then you rub your eyes, it's gonna hurt.
Well, yeah, but
just,
I mean.
It's a scale of how much it hurts.
Right. But you were like, I have to wear gloves to plant these.
Yes, that's true.
That's some
tweezers.
Serious shit. Yeah.
Yeah, that was.
that's nothing like a jalapeno.
No, it was. I did mess up in the planting stages. I think that was the scorpions. Yeah, that was really painful.
Yeah.
And it wasn't from touching the seeds. It was from touching the package the seeds came in. Someone had handled the seeds and then touched.
Oh,
so good.
Who's like, oh man, I touched this and it hurts so bad. I need to find a way to eat it.
I got this this Trinidad scorpion hot sauce like 4 days ago.
Uh-huh.
And you can see, Jordan, it
Holy
is three quarters
shit.
Gone. Yeah, it's great. It's a really good sauce.
You like putting hot sauce on stuff.
I do. I like my food to hurt.
Oh, God, there's a lot of metaphors there.
Certainly.
Yep.
This is a podcast where I know a lot about peppers, sort of, and Alex Jones quite a bit.
And I don't know anything about either.
Correct. Jordan, today we are in the past. We are going back to the year of 2013. To continue our ongoing investigation of how Alex Jones covered the fallout of Sandy Hook and everything else around that. Mm-hmm. And today we're going over February 21st and 22nd. I'll tell you in advance, February 22nd is a bit of a no man's land.
Garbage, huh?
There's nothing going on that show. He is just rambling about how the government's going to take guns away from veterans.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty much the entire show.
Yeah, they do that.
It is not worth it. Just tons and tons of stuff of, like, things we've already gone over. Mm-hmm. It would just be rote repetition of this isn't true. This isn't true.
Right.
This is nonsense.
We've said that before.
We have. But February 21st, there's a bit more meat on that there bone, and so we shall go over it. But first, I'm going to take a moment to say thank you to some people who have signed up and are supporting the show, and we really appreciate it. So, first of all, I'd like to say thank you to Thomas. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Thomas.
Thomas.
Next, Tyler. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Tyler.
Tyler.
Next, Anna. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you,
Thanks, Anna.
Next, Boxcar Willie Nelson. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you, Boxcar Willie Nelson.
Next, Lucrece. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
I am almost certain I mispronounced that, and I apologize.
But it also
makes me think of the great Blood, Sweat, and Tears song, Lucretia McEvil.
Oh, yeah? I was thinking of Lucrezia Borgia. That's who I was thinking
That's
of.
Probably a much closer pronunciation. But I will say that Lucrezia McEvil is a great song.
Was that Block Rock and Beats? I think?
No. Horde Rock. So finally, I'd like to say thank you to somebody who donated on an elevated level. We appreciate it very much. So, Regina, thank you so much. You are now a technocrat.
I'm a policy wonk.
Crikey, mate, that's fantastic. Have yourself a brew.
How's your 401k doing, bro?
All right, we got to go full tilt boogie on this, Watson, all right? Let's just get down to business. We ain't making that money off that heroin. Why are you pimp so good? My neck is freakishly large. I declare info war on you.
Thank you, Regina.
Thank you very much, Regina.
Capital of Saskatchewan.
Is it?
It is.
What else is Regina?
I think it's derived from like Queen, right? Isn't it?
Regis. Yeah, something along those lines.
Anyway, we appreciate it. Thank you very much. If you like what we do and like to support the show, you can do that by going to our website, knowledgefight.com, clicking the button that says support the show. We would appreciate it.
Please do.
So, Jordan, I started listening to this episode, this February 21st episode, and I heard Alex say something that excited me to no end. Now,
free ice cream.
That would be very exciting. It is hot out.
Yes, it is.
We have finally hit summer in Chicago, and it is ice cream weather. That is not what he says.
Okay.
This is the sort of thing that I, looking back at digging into past episodes of Alex's show, this is exactly what you want to hear. Now, he doesn't follow through on this, but it's the sort of thing you really get excited to hear.
I don't want to say this broadcast is in a rut because we've added a lot of new things to it. It's gotten better. We've got the reporters, more and more special news pieces. It's just that at the level this broadcast has already made it, I am going to attempt to really shake the show up.
That's really exciting.
That would have been amazing.
That is so exciting to hear. An awareness on Alex's part that he's in a rut.
Yeah.
Because he is. In this late February stretch of time, like, he is kind of in a holding pattern. He's kind of got about all he can out of the Piers Morgan shit.
Right.
He's got this WWE narrative with Jack Swagger going, but it doesn't, you can almost get a sense that he doesn't even feel like this is, like, really gonna do that much for him.
Yeah.
And I think from listening to these episodes, I could get a sense that he realizes they're more interested in Glenn Beck also.
Yeah.
So I think that he does feel like, I got to do something. We're in a rut. I got to mix it up.
Yeah. I like that. I like that. He's been talking about the same boring nonsense. The WWE is unrequited love. He's not going to get there. He needs to go back to his old broadcast.
Right.
Really rekindle the flame there. Like maybe try a little bondage, little light bondage stuff. You know, get the emotion back in there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, maybe. I think a wacky sidekick would do it.
Okay, well, that would work too.
I think there's a lot of options for what he could do to mix things up. Reed?
No, I don't think that would happen.
No, I don't think it would help.
No.
Sound effect board.
I like a sound effect. Ooh, fart noises.
Can you imagine Alex Jones if he had like a...
God.
Kazoo noises.
Or just like a...
Yeah.
They are coming to take our guns! That would be great.
Like a vuvuzela drop.
Oh, hell yeah.
Air horns. I would love it. But like I said, he doesn't really follow through with this. At least not in the 21st and 22nd that I've listened to. I see no evidence of him shaking anything up. It is a very similar type of broadcast. But interestingly, as an extension of him saying that he needs to mix things up and the show's kind of in a rut, he is expressing like a good amount of self-awareness, which I find very interesting because it's usually pretty absent. Like, he makes a couple of really valid complaints about himself in this next clip.
There's the issue of the frustration of every day I come in here, and I've scanned over before I got here and then when I get here, sometimes 200 articles, usually about 100. I've got all these video clips, all these reports, all this incredible information, all these insights to try to transmit to you, but I get so excited and go into a rant mode, and the first hour is generally the best hour for my content, and then we usually have guests on because I know that I tend to degenerate by the second and third hour. And it's on the days where I don't have guests, where I decide to not have guests, that becomes evident. And I'm probably overanalyzing this. It's just that these are extraordinary times we're in. Very extraordinary times. And so I must, absolutely must, get myself to the point of where I'm in control. Because I'll say I'm going to go to your calls, I don't go to them. Or when I do, I let a caller go too long. Or I say I'm going to cover something in the next hour. I start covering it right then and then never fully cover it.
I don't believe him about reading 100 articles in preparation for the show or anything like that. But some of those criticisms of himself are quite valid.
They are dead on.
The first hour is usually the best hour because he does fall apart towards the end of episodes.
Right.
Generally, he's just kind of saying nothing and treading water by the third hour. I never go to calls when I say I'm going to go to calls.
Totally
absolutely
true.
Absolutely a valid criticism. I say I'm going to cover something later and then I just start rambling about it and never really cover it.
Yeah.
That is a hallmark of your show.
Yeah, that's more of a feature, not a bug to your show, actually.
Yeah, that's how you get away with not covering things.
Yeah.
This is very weird to me.
This is weird. It sounds like the head of HR brought him in for a performance review.
And his dad?
Yes, exactly.
I don't know if his dad was HR back then. I don't remember the timeline exactly.
Maybe that's why his dad is HR now, is because there was a head of human resources and
he told Alex, take more calls.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but there's a moment of introspection here that I find very uncharacteristic of him. I mean, he does feel down sometimes about himself, but this level of opening the show with, we need to mix it up. I'm pretty not good after an hour a lot of the time, so I overcompensate by having guests on. I never cover news, and I don't take calls when I say I'm going to. We need to change that.
I think I figured it out. We are in a 13 going on 30 situation. He and Rex swapped bodies. So Rex is telling the truth through Alex's mouth. Mm. And then for some reason, they probably stepped on the same lucky penny, but with Lincoln's face down.
Okay.
So that's when they swapped back, and the next day he's right back to his bullshit.
I mean, it's possible.
That makes perfect sense to me.
All right. There's a theory. I have other theories that are much less specific. He's not feeling great and he realizes the bad job he's doing and he was capable of doing better.
That sounds right.
That seems more in line with his psychology. but as an extension of this, he says a couple of really fucking weird things on this episode that I think are kind of revealing of when he's being more critical and more self-aware, these sorts of ideas come to the surface. Now, we've already heard him say that you gotta give it up to the Somali pirates, which was groundbreaking in how shocking it was.
Yes, yeah.
To hear him be pro Somali pirates. But it turns out there's another group of people you gotta hand it to.
I mean, this is an epic time to be alive. An epic plan we face. Epic eugenicist-based technocrat globalist who, you gotta hand it to them, have had a long-term nightmare plan and have really carried a lot of it out. They're about 10 years behind.
You gotta hand it to the globalists. That's weird. So he's not done. He has some more thoughts to expound on here, but it's always like, you do not have to hand it to the globalists. They're your mortal enemies. You do not have to hand it to them.
I mean, it's epic. And a lot of technocrats will say, well, Alex, they're in control. We're in control. Speaking of themselves, we're going to win. And you should just try to join us. Isn't the fact that we're in control the evidence that we should be in charge? And I sat there and watched a lot of my family die of cancer. And I've watched friends die of cancer. I've watched people take their last breaths. Even though it was painful, it was important moments to experience that death, not to hide away from it, to see it, to know how transient we are. Out, out, brief candle, to quote Shakespeare.
Life is very fragile, to quote Shakespeare.
And I have sat there and watched people battle cancer. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. If cancer had a consciousness, it would think it was winning. No, you are not winning, and you do not have a right to be doing what you're doing, because your eugenics would be bad enough if you were killing the infirm and the stupid. But you are targeting the beautiful and the intelligent and the enlightened because you're threatened by it. And that is just beyond, beyond evil. You people are cancer.
Okay.
So,
but you gotta give it up to cancer. It does a pretty good job.
You gotta give it up to how epic it is.
Epic cancer.
I mean, it's hard to, taken outside of any context, I don't know how terrible that is, because he's expressing like, okay, so a parasitic system that kills its host, it would think that it was winning as it was killing the host.
Right.
And taking the resources from the host to survive. But in doing so, it leads to its own death.
Right.
Like, I think that there's
you just described colonialism.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's I don't know how far off he is in terms of just saying things, but you can't take that outside of the context of his worldview.
Right.
And so much of his fear and so much of his rhetoric is about there being like a plan to destroy whites or a plan to get rid of the middle class, which he very clearly expresses is mostly white. There, all of this is an attack on the gun community, the patriots. Like, you can't hear him say stuff like, you are attacking the beautiful and the intelligent, without thinking, like, you're speaking in code a little bit
here. Yeah.
You're saying that your eugenics would be bad if you were just dealing with the people I don't like.
Right.
But you are dealing with the people who are similar to me, and targeting them with your eugenics.
Can't have
and
that.
And that, to me, is...
Step too far.
No good.
Absolutely not.
I do feel like that's part of what he's expressing there. Taken in the context of his work and the views that we know he has.
Yeah. It kind of...
Because you wouldn't be carrying out eugenics against people who like guns.
Right. It kind of fucks me up a little bit because he is being introspective and like self-reflective. And at the same time, he's still saying that he's still speaking to the globalists like they are absolutely real.
Yeah.
Which screws with my head because it's like, wait, so do you really believe all this bullshit?
You can't ever tilt your hand on that one, though. No matter how introspective you are, your brand is gone if you indicate that, like, you have any doubt of your worldview.
Right, but he doesn't have any doubt.
Well, I think that would be easy to masquerade.
While he's doubting himself.
Wow.
That's troublesome.
I don't know. I'm not as troubled by it, but I see what you're saying. I think there's something there. But this sort of self-critical, introspective Alex is also expressed by virtue of his interactions with a caller. This guy calls in and wants to talk chemtrails, and he thinks he's found a way to prove all of the arguments about chemtrails.
All right.
And Alex's response to this guy is pretty amazing.
Fuck you.
I wanted to mention the modified atmosphere. Several months ago, I obtained, and I want to encourage others to do it. If they've already done it, great, and others should need to do this as well. Get a hold of a microscope. Get some rain samples. Look at your rain under a microscope. Look at what is falling on you. It's mind-boggling. I have water samples still that I have kept for several months in my refrigerator, and it's amazing what happens over the long term. The little glass containers I have the water in, when I first collected it with the cap on it, if you shook it up, it looked like Santa Claus should be standing in there. And now, over the course of several months, all of those disgusting fibers and God knows what that's in there has all clumped together. And
shoot a YouTube video of that and show it, but that's really unscientific, and I'm not poo-pooing the fact that you're doing that. That's a good way to start out observing things, and I appreciate your call.
Alex pointing out that something is unscientific is surprising.
Yeah, I'm thrown off.
Yeah,
I'm thrown off.
It's very weird. There's a sense of, like, any other day, he might have jumped on that.
Yeah.
And been like, well, not only that. Used it as a way to pivot into
something he did want to talk about.
Some chemtrail narrative that he is into.
Yeah. He would have been like, oh, that's really interesting. That's also like whenever you see
wouldn't have poo-pooed on it and then said, I'm not poo-pooing you doing that.
He wouldn't have just said, like, hey, yeah.
You didn't prove shit.
You looked at stuff and hold on. That's a great way to look at stuff to start, you know, but don't.
Right.
Stop, leave me alone.
It's great that you want to go down this avenue.
Yeah.
But what you're doing isn't scientific and you haven't proven anything.
It was almost a little paternal as well.
Yeah.
It's just like, you are spending your time the way you're gonna spend your time.
Now, what's interesting about that is that Alex is capable of that.
Yeah.
Like, seeing those type of moments are always kind of shocking because it's like, you could respond to everyone like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no caller that has something that's so wildly different from what that guy said that you couldn't use that response on anything.
Yeah, anytime someone tries to convince you of bullshit or say some nonsense, you could just be like, well, hold on now. You are capable of it. You're capable of critical thinking, or at least were in 2013 to an extent that, like, it makes it so much worse. It makes all the incredulousness, all of the, like, easily foolable elements of him, like, it it's damning. It's really damning to see him operate like an adult.
Yeah, I know. it's worse. It's worse.
Yeah.
It says that it's there. It says, or he does have a sound drop board, and that's very unscientific, is one that he recorded a long time ago.
Yeah, this is just,
this is just him playing little doo doo doo.
Yeah, it could be. So there's those indications of those weirdnesses that come up. But like I said, in the same way that, you know, you have that, you gotta give it to the globalist cancer bit. There are also, more indications of, like, him expressing weird ideas that you kind of always feel like he believes, but doesn't really overtly say. And this next one is about how everyone's gonna be replaced by robots. And I think underneath it is something that maybe we haven't done a good job of analyzing, but I think is a firm belief of Alex's.
Humans are out of it. Humans won't be working at McDonald's. They won't be working in factories. They won't be working in the military. You'll have technicians that back up the robots in case they have problems. But already top engineers don't even know how the computers work, and none of them can even tell how they all go together now. And the algorithms are all out of control. So you'll just basically have computers working on the computers. And at that point, the globalists are going to release the bioweapon. Just get rid of us. We're not needed anymore. They officially say they're going to kill us. What do you think about that?
That's insane.
Oh, you're saying that to a person.
Yeah, I was explaining that to a caller.
Caller got that? Ooh.
Yeah. So the thing that I think is interesting that's underneath that is a feeling that the globalists, at least, seem to believe, in Alex's conception, that the only value of human life is based on work.
Mm.
And I think that Alex believes that. I think he agrees with that.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that, okay, so robots take over all the jobs, let's say, and then people don't have to work. Well, kill them all.
Yeah.
Alex believes that his enemies believe that, but at the same time, he doesn't seem to offer any kind of real world solution to this, or any kind of real sense that humans have value outside of work.
Yeah, he doesn't really disagree with them.
His solution is to get rid of the robots at work and keep people working.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, conceiving of or imagining a society where your value isn't based off your work that you're able to put in at a factory. Or whatever.
Yeah, it is interesting that in his very conception, because he's projecting this false hate from onto the globalists, he's functioning on the same spectrum, which the only value of a human being is in their work is taken as read by each side.
Yeah.
So
their solution is to get robots in and kill everybody. His is keep people working so they still have
value.
And
kill all the robots. Yeah. It's just a we're on the same
It's very strange. And I think the fact that, you know, if his enemies are such that, you know, we're going to replace humans with robots, and then because they're not working, they're expendable, and we can kill them all with a bioweapon.
Yeah.
If he believes that that's what his enemies believe, then it should be contingent upon him to create such a groundswell of popular support and excitement around the idea that we aren't just our work. There is an entire beautiful world we could create if we weren't tied to jobs, tied to, like, that being the end-all, be-all of our existence.
Right.
Like, the amazing community things we could do. The amazing cleaning up of nature we could do. There's so much.
That sounds like something we should get our robots to do for us.
Yeah, probably. People exploring hobbies. The creative renaissance that we could go through.
Right.
People were allowed to follow their passions and had the freedom to be able to do it. I don't really see a ton of that from him in terms of, like, that being a solution to the problem.
Right.
It's just, don't shut down the coal plants and keep people working in car factories in America.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that isn't a great solution to his perceived problem. And it leads me to believe that he believes the same thing as the globalist, in as much as humans are only valuable as work.
Right. I suppose the thing that I would add to that is that it is something of a very rational fear with an imagined outcome. Like, I do absolutely think that major corporations are doing everything possible at all times to automate as much of the labor as possible.
Yes.
And I absolutely think that it is unreasonable to think that they really care what happens to people after that.
No, totally. I mean, one of the things...
It's a rational fear.
Yeah.
The irrational fear is the part where they're all going to kill us then.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Like, so that's one of the... That's another part of his worldview that is just assumed on there.
Mm-hmm.
If they are doing one thing and it is real, then... I'm not going to think about what might happen next. I'm only going to think that it's apocalypse.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
If any part of the status quo changes, even the slightest bit,
right.
Apocalypse.
Apocalypse. So in this next clip, Alex talks about his love of the John Birch Society, which is, I mean, we already know that he loves the John Birch Society, but he doesn't talk about it all that often. So I find it important to point out when he does.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, your calls and a ton of news are coming up, but I'm basically trying to break down how the world works, what the driving philosophy of the controllers are. So they've gone for 50 years saying, oh, the John Birch Society, the lying demons, because it was only the John Birch Society in the 50s and 60s that was even covering any of this. And so they would go, oh, those crazy conspiracy theorists, they say our government put Mao in. Oh, all been declassified in the mid-90s. CIA put him in, 1949, declassified, go look it up.
I did. When Alex talks about, like, people thinking the John Birch Society was crazy, it's because they were.
Oh, yeah, they were fucked up.
And they weren't just, like, some kind of, hey, we're cool, we just don't like communists type of people. They were really, really, really fucked up. And if you look at the materials that they distributed, like especially in their early times, it gives you a good example of what they were really about. One of the first books that they put out and was sent to all their meetings was this book called The John Franklin Letters. And it is a insane, violent fantasy in sort of the same conversation as the Turner Diaries or the unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of militia fantasy of violent revolt.
Yeah.
Against a government that has gotten too collectivist or whatever.
Sure.
That is a big piece of their DNA. And it was one of the first books that they ever put out, and distributed. And so when Alex talks about, like, his dad being, at least adjacent to the John Birch Society and it being a part of his childhood, it makes it very difficult for me not to imagine that the John Franklin Letters was something that Alex may have had access to, when he was a wee boy, which is fucked up because that book is a real serious mess.
Yeah, it does make sense, of, you know, his enduring hatred for, football and all of those things that sublimate the male desire to kill, because basically what he's doing is living out murder fantasies through these militia books and all that stuff. He's angry at those because he doesn't want to sublimate his desire to fight a war. He wants to get his murder boner on.
Yeah. Yep. There is something to that. Probably. So, I mean, also the John Franklin letters, just to give some sense of, like what it's all about. It was written probably, it's anonymously written, but it was most likely written by a guy named Revilo P. Oliver, who was one of the founding members of the John Birch Society. And he had to sort of get out of the group because he was too openly anti-Semitic and too much of a bigot. And he would go on to join William Luther Pierce, to form the National Alliance. And of course, William Luther Pierce was the guy who wrote the Turner Diaries, which inspired, Timothy McVeigh to, do the whole Murrah Building bombing.
Right. So good dudes all around.
And from an interview that I was able to find, Pierce discusses, like, his inspiration for writing the Turner Diaries was Revilo Oliver giving him a copy of the John Franklin letters, which helped him sort of figure out how he wanted to write his book and
They're all just writing fan fiction of older fan fiction about militias.
It does feel that way. And so, like, a lot of that stuff, like, just the idea that it's a benign anti-communist organization that just felt like, we don't like commies, is absurd. It from the beginning was a deeply fucked up propaganda strategy.
Yeah.
And also probably had more to do with suppressing workers' rights than it did in its actual opposition to communism.
Isn't that strange when a bunch of rich people get together? There's always a thing that they say they're doing, but man, it sure helps that their businesses are profiting off of it.
So, and also, towards the China issue, because Alex seems to be allergic to speaking in specific terms, I can't really know exactly what declassified document from the CIA he's talking about that proved that the CIA put Mao into power in 1949.
Was that one of his self-criticisms, that he was allergic to providing specifics?
That is my assessment.
That one was yours. Yeah, okay, yeah. All right.
But left with no real alternatives to get to the bottom of it, I just decided to read a bunch of the CIA's declassified information from the years around 1949 that involved China, and spoiler alert, none of them say that they installed Mao. On July 22nd, 1948, the CIA put out a report titled "The Current Situation in China." In the report, the situation is described as being not very good. The support for nationalist Chiang Kai-shek, quote, is steadily weakening because of the unsuccessful prosecution of the war under his leadership and his apparent unwillingness and inability to accomplish positive reforms. The report describes increasing instability in the nationalist side of the Chinese Civil War, which was unlikely to be something that we could resolve no matter what we did. The report is not pro-communist or pro-Mao in any way. It says, quote, "The prospect for the foreseeable future in China is at best an indefinite and inconclusive prolongation of the civil war, with the authority of the national government limited to a dwindling area in the central and south China and isolated major cities in north and northeast China. The worst prospect is complete collapse of the national government and its replacement by a Chinese communist-controlled regime under Soviet influence, if not under Soviet control, and uncooperative towards the United States, if not openly hostile." So strange that they would describe the communists coming to power as the worst-case scenario in a classified document if that's exactly what they were working towards. According to the report's assessment, the U.S. was in a really precarious position. The U.S. had passed a bill providing aid to Chiang Kai-shek, but his government was increasingly ineffective and facing opposition not just from the communists, but also from within. Anti-U.S. sentiment had been growing, not only from the communists, with many thinking that the U.S. was taking a side in a civil matter in the hopes of turning China into a giant colony. Were the U.S. to increase the aid offered to Chiang Kai-shek, that sentiment would almost certainly have grown, and along with it, anti-Shek resistance. At the same time, the question of the USSR loomed large. Increased aid for the nationalists could very easily result in the USSR formally and materially supporting the Chinese communists in that civil war, which could get out of hand really, really easily. Considering a lot of these variables, the report points out that, quote, "many Chinese view the U.S. aid program as prolonging the agony of rather than resolving the civil war." That was a sentiment that we couldn't fight, really. There was not much we could do. Chiang Kai-shek was doing a terrible job of running the war, and he was doing a horrible job of inspiring his side with a positive vision of what comes after the war. The CIA assessments and reports this time are in full acknowledgement of the uphill battle that would be involved in trying to somehow help him win the Civil War, and how even if the U.S. was able to lead him to victory, it would likely not be a good thing, since his government was completely unstable, and in all likelihood he wouldn't be able to effectively govern the country. If we were to get involved, it would likely involve a full military commitment, as well as a pretty high level of us forcing reforms on his nationalist government, which would be basically turning China into a U.S. colony. This sort of thing would obviously trigger a backlash from the Soviet Union, who have a strategic interest in their neighbor not being a U.S. puppet state. The issue of the U.S. position in the rise of the Communist Party in China is an infinitely complex one, but I can find no evidence that the CIA put Mao into power. The best argument you could make is that the U.S. didn't determine that it was in their best interests to enter a full-scale war in order to support Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists. If that's the argument Alex wants to make, then by all means, he should make it. I suspect he doesn't present this situation honestly, because if he did, he would be advocating for a foreign war specifically in the interest of nation-building and imprinting U.S. foreign policy on another country, which he presumably is supposed to be against. The idea that the CIA installed Mao into power, it's the exclusive domain of insane anti-communist propagandists. At the time, strident anti-communists wanted the U.S. to get militarily involved in against the communists because it would create a problem for Stalin on his eastern border. When the U.S. didn't pursue that strategy because of its obvious horrible consequences that it would have brought, they interpreted that as the U.S. not wanting to apply that eastern pressure on Stalin, which was then translated into being active support for the communist regimes in the USSR and China. That's all that's going on here.
Yeah.
It's revisionist history, oversimplification in order to create a way in which this supports communism. And
right.
It doesn't.
Right, right, right. It's
stupid.
And it's run by the John Boltons of their day who are just going for, I want to kill these people. And I don't care the consequences.
It's probably worse, honestly.
I agree, yeah.
Because,
yeah.
Like, John Bolton, as bad as he is, like, I don't think that he...
At least he's not trying to take over China.
Well, and I don't think that he would be able to be as effective 50 years from now as the John Birch Society was in the early 60s. You know, like,
yeah.
his influence is insidious and it's awful and it'll probably cause untold pain in a lot of people's lives. But I don't know if he'll start a school.
Yeah.
You know, a school of thought that even when forced to go underground because of the people who looked at it as like such stupid shit.
Yeah.
It still is very, influential. So anyway, John Birch Society sucks. They're the worst. And,
yep.
CIA didn't put Mao into power.
Doubtful.
In 1949. This is absurd. So, in this next clip, Alex discusses how there's gonna be a civil war, cause of course there is.
Well, why not?
It's interesting that, like, he's always saying that, you know?
Yeah.
With the intensity and, like, pressure that he's saying it in 2019, it's like, well, man, it's finally come to this. You can go back to 2013, he's like, well, it's probably gonna be a civil war.
Yeah.
Nah, it's just sort of, you're a broken record, you just say that all the time. But, when this civil war happens, Jordan, it's important to remember that the right-wing side in that civil war is going to be fake.
What? What?
It's interesting.
Hold on. What now?
And they do synthetic wars. They make them up. They run all the sides. So I see them getting it all ready. And I'm like, hey, the plan is they're going to say he's Lincoln. They're going to start a civil war. And so the entire program is set up, though, to where they'll artificially represent the states and call it Confederate. When the states and the Declaration of Independence and the people can reconstitute the government whenever they want, they want to build it federal government against the states and the evil whites. That's the new targets, the bullet training, the manuals. They want a false billet. It's us minorities and a loving socialist government against the evil white right-wingers. Kill anybody in a John Deere hat. Let's get them. Yeah. Okay. Now, they want to push that false idea instead of people like Sheriff Clark, who's black and super smart and well-spoken, has a hero background.
What's going on here?
Along with 400 other sheriffs now, saying this is going to cause a revolution. We're going to be with the people. That totally freaks the system out. In fact, if I was the globalist, this is the type of person I'd go after, is Clark.
There's other reasons to go after him, like him being a monster. But that clip is a large part of earlier when he's talking about, like, you're going after the good, beautiful people.
Yeah.
Why I think there's a little bit of code.
Yeah.
Because he's saying, like, you're trying to target the white right-wingers. So that wouldn't be a consideration if it weren't, like, this is how he sees things.
Yeah.
Oh, on this side, it's going to be the minorities and the socialists.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, buddy.
Yeah. It does.
It's pretty clear what you're saying.
It does kind of seem like you're saying that they're manufacturing an enemy, except you're creating the strictures within which they've manufactured. Like, because his enemy is imagined, he is imagining what his enemy would think of him.
Right.
And actually just telling us what he thinks he is.
Yeah, there's something to that. Yep. So there's going to be a civil war, and the right-wing side is going to be manufactured because they're going to create this whole war, and that all of it is just to demonize his side or something. He has a really grandiose
idea. How are they
going to
be manufactured, though?
What does that mean?
I mean, like, how are they going to, how are they going to do the whole thing?
I wish I knew.
Like, they're going to manufacture an entire side?
Yeah. I mean, I guess probably, if I had to guess, because I don't think he really lays this out specifically, it would be by, like, tricking some people on Alex's side to falling in with the paradigm and getting involved in the war. So they would be duped into it.
Okay.
Or just, like, I guess, agent provocateurs starting up militias. You know, he already thinks that all people who are in the Klan are feds and shit like that.
Fair, fair.
So, I mean, I guess you would probably say that would be how it works.
And you would have to then create an entire side of loosely knit, barely even associated people and put them under one banner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, call them all one thing. And then, like you said, the goal there is to take, you know, shoot anybody with a John Deere hat,
right?
Because you characterized an entire side,
right?
As, and so you only need to see one thing, like if they had a milkshake, mm-hmm. you know, then it would be worth shooting them.
Yeah,
it's almost like he's manufacturing a goddamn civil war.
I mean, it. Yeah, I didn't say this made sense, but it does. It is interesting how his mind works like
yeah.
that. And actually, this next clip is another one of these like moments of introspection that I think go awry.
Mm-hmm.
Here you hear him say something that I think might be the truest thing I've ever heard on Alex's show.
But I mean, the thing is, if you knew what I knew, which isn't hard to know. If you understood my mind and understood the history, we could defeat them very quickly.
Now, that's not true in a strict
sense. In the
sense
that he said.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do think that if you understood how his brain works, it would be easy to defeat these globalists because
yes.
they're imaginary.
Yes,
so
exactly.
So if you understand how his brain works and how he oversimplifies things, how he doesn't look for context and anything... He doesn't look for the reality in things. He looks for the angle or whatever. You know, like, if you understood that, it would be
right.
easy to defeat this imagined enemy because you'd be like, oh, yeah, that's just your brain.
Right.
That's just your brain, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big heaping pile of confirmation bias that's sitting at the bottom of your shit skull.
If you understood how my brain worked, we could end this easily.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, we could.
If all of your audience understood how full of shit you are, we could all be done with this a long time ago. I agree. That is true.
Yep.
Congratulations, Alex. You have spoken truth accidentally. So when he's saying that, though, that's not what he's saying. He's saying that if you understood the code that I understand, much like Leo Zagami having the only true code that Jesus would have, as proven by the Vatican.
Of course.
If you understood that code, they could defeat the globalists very easily. And here's how you defeat the globalists.
How do we defeat this? Well, first off, we see the globalists want to divide and conquer everybody. And we see they want to get rid of borders and bring in globalism to replace our republic. So basically, anything the globalists are for, we need to be against. If they're for taking guns, there are intellectual arguments for guns, obviously. But we just know to be against gun control because the globalists are tyrants and want to take our guns to enslave us. So I don't debate or argue with them.
Do you understand how this thinking could go very poorly? You have a guy who's the arbiter of a completely unexplainable plan that these evil globalists are doing.
Yeah.
And you don't debate these sorts of things. You just are automatically against whatever they're for.
Yeah.
So if he is the guy who understands in a way that, like, if only you understood, this would be so easy. If only you could see all that I see. The globalists believe X. So you should be against X. It might just be a really good way to get people to believe something foolishly and unquestioningly.
Yeah, it does seem like the questioning part of that is what he's really trying to stamp out.
Yeah,
He really doesn't want the question part.
Now, sure, there are intellectual arguments for all of the things that I believe, but fuck it. Just be oppositional, defiant, just be, like, reactionary and completely opposed to anything I tell you our enemies are for.
Yeah.
That's fucking stupid.
It is a recipe for self-destruction more than anything else.
Yeah.
Because even if you take that thinking anywhere, like, okay, fine. So you get rid of all the people who disagree with you, all of the globalists, and now all you're left with are the right-wing patriots that you love to hang out with so much.
John Deere is doing big business.
Big business. But hold on. Your only existence is against what somebody else does. So, in your little group, somebody says, hey, I don't think we should do this. Well, guess who that guy is? He's a fucking globalist now.
Neo-globalist.
So he's another, there's a whole nother type of globalist. And so you fracture that shit up again. And
fourth wave globalist.
Fine. I mean, you get rid of that. And then you get into a smaller group. And then one guy disagrees with you. And then it's murder.
I mean, you see the same thing happening in the right wing a lot. Like, and I imagine it probably does happen in the left too, but I don't pay nearly as much attention to pundits on the left as I do Alex and his stupid world. But the way they all turn on each other, the way Alex tried to declare war on Ben Shapiro, the time that Alex had Jason Kessler, the guy who organized the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally on, and tried to accuse him of being a Fed
air.
Like, that sort of behavior is so, like, whenever you dwell in a world of paranoia, everyone is the target of that paranoia.
Absolutely.
It's inevitable. Once you defeat X enemy, Y shows up.
Yep.
It is inevitable for his system.
Yeah.
And it's interesting the way that he talks about the globalists too. Like, he talks about whenever they end up, like, killing off most of the population, you think they aren't going to turn on each other? Like, he understands that in terms of them.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
But it doesn't feel like it applies to his group, at all.
It's always weird when he does one of these introspective episodes because it feels like in trying to figure out his enemies, he is trying to figure out himself, but publicly telling you he's trying to figure out himself.
He probably just
and trying
like,
to explain about the enemies.
He probably, you know, thinks that going to therapy is weak.
Yeah.
He's just working it all out.
Yeah.
So, in this next clip, Alex talks about something that Obama is doing that is bad, though is identical to something he celebrated Trump doing.
Look at Obama trying to rally all his idiot minions to go after guns and saying, I need your horrible stories of what happened to you to personalize it. One man's a tragedy, a million's a statistic, as Stalin said. Because it's a culture war.
Alex was very excited about the idea of Trump soliciting stories of violence by immigrants when Trump was on that tip not too long ago. Alex was very excited about that, thought it was very important. These stories need to be told.
Yep.
And I know that hypocrisy is pointless to point out, but it is just so explicit. It's so direct, the parallel.
I know. You want at least one little measure removed, so you have to think for a second, and then you're like, oh, that's hypocritical. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to just be a fucking mirror pointed at you. Just like,
it's rough.
Yeah, come on, man. At least try and hide it a little bit.
Yeah. I think that this next clip is probably one of the most overt problems that I have with this episode. And I think that it's Alex undercutting pretty much all of his own beliefs. I know that I've said that before in the past, like whenever there's something that's like really deeply, in conflict with his primary brand and the way he tries to present himself. But something he says in this clip makes me think like, ugh.
They've taught so many yuppies. They go, I don't care. Kill the Iraqis. They're not human. Do you think the globalists who don't think Iraqis are human think you're human either? They respect them a lot more than your big lazy butt. They think of you as a dumb animal who they don't want to take care of anymore. You're like, but I work. They don't care. They see the resources as theirs. They don't think you're human. They don't think you deserve to live. And here's my beef with the globalist. Maybe some of the public who wants to be slaves and hear this, maybe they do deserve to be slaves. I don't, okay? I'm not going to be a slave.
I don't believe that someone like Alex, who presents himself the way he does, with the belief set that he has, should ever be indicating that he believes that some people deserve to be slaves.
Maybe some of them should be slaves, Dan, but that's not my job. I'm not the arbiter of who should or should not be slaves.
It's not even that he's saying. He's saying that he personally will not
be. I know.
But some people, they deserve it. Some people, I don't caught into that. I don't believe that, for a second. I don't believe that just because you don't agree with whatever I believe, you deserve to be the victim of the consequences of that. In the same way that, like, a good example is people who don't believe in, like, universal health care. I don't believe that if that is to be passed, they should be excluded from the benefits of it.
Of course not.
Just because they were against it doesn't mean they shouldn't have the positive benefit of it. I don't think that it is right in any way for Alex to think, like, oh, all right, you're not on my team. You deserve to be enslaved.
Yeah.
I will be fine with you being enslaved. You're about human liberty. Your whole thing is liberty. You should be opposed to it in every context.
No, you have to choose it, and if you don't choose it, then you lose it, Dan. That's how it works. If you don't choose to join Alex and be free, then you lose your freedom. And that makes sense.
Or at least we're fine with it.
Yeah.
That is not okay. That is absolutely not okay.
Insane.
It indicates less of an interest in freedom, less an interest in truly, like, people being free, and more an interest in his team.
Yeah.
That's really all I can hear there.
I mean, a very simple test of any kind of partisan leading or any plans or anything like that is, will this only benefit the people who agree with me, or will this benefit everybody? And it seems like the only thing Alex is interested in is benefiting people who agree with him.
Or at least not giving a shit about the people who don't.
Like, right.
In the ways that they may be hurt.
Right.
And I think you even hear a little bit in that clip, too, about like work being the only thing that
gives
value.
I work.
Yeah.
Whoa, why are you doing this to me? I work. Right. I'm not unemployed. I'm not one of those people who you can do these things to.
Right. There is a sense of, like, again, he's using the globalists to express that position, but there is still a willingness to engage with that idea and it defining value, which is weird.
Yeah, this all sounds a little bit to me like when I get really insecure and depressed and I'm like, man, I don't know. Why am I even doing any of this stuff? I'm not any good at this. I'm terrible. And it's just like, I direct it towards me and he seems to direct it towards the globalists, making him feel bad, you know?
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, it all goes back to that. Don't make me feel bad.
Yeah. Don't make me feel bad. Yeah.
So in this next clip, we find that the GOP ain't going to do it. I'm going to do it. Tea Party. That's the only hope for America.
Yeah.
And it's the full, you've got Karl Rove saying, open the borders, world government, socialism is good, the Tea Party is evil, and it's weak, and it's dead, and it's over. And you've got the same thing coming out of the WWE. That's because the Tea Party is the only hope. What the ideas of the real Tea Party, the real libertarian constitutional rediscovery of America. We need 1498 part deuce. We'll be right back with Sean and others.
So, I mean, like, if you think Karl Rove is a socialist,
We're well far gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeesh. I don't even know what that would make me if Karl Rove is a socialist.
I mean, it's just the way to, you know, it's the same, it's just nonsense. It's a way of, making sure that everyone falls under your negative heading.
Uh-huh.
I guess just probably anybody who believes in any kind of social safety net of any sort is probably a socialist, according to Alex.
Probably. That sounds right. What is he talking about, 1498 part deuce?
See, that's interesting. I'm not sure.
I was trying to figure out if I knew any. I was like, wait.
Christopher Columbus.
Is he talking 1492? No, that doesn't sound right. But that's the only number that would make
Columbus
sense.
Christopher Columbus did some stuff in, like, South America in 1498. Leonardo da Vinci finished his painting of The Last Supper.
Okay.
In 1498.
That so we need a new painting?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, like, he's obsessed with the Renaissance. Talks about that a lot. But that had already been started by 1498. You know, it had been going for quite a while. The only thing that's, like, really huge from 1498 in history is that's when Vasco da Gama arrived in India. Circumnavigated south of Africa and ended up there creating the spice trade.
That was
in 1498, but I can't imagine how that's related
Alex
to the...
Maybe Alex is just hungry.
I don't understand how that's related to what he's talking about.
I don't know.
There must be something that happened. I don't know.
Was that when white nationalism began? Because I feel like it was way earlier than that.
Yeah, probably. So earlier we heard Alex talk about Sheriff Clark being great, and that's whatever. But I think that what we see is an indication that Alex having him on was very much a strategy in order to be able to report on having him on.
Yeah.
Because he is a sheriff that's pretty popular. People are paying attention to him. And so Alex being able to attach his name to this group, like, because no one gives a fuck if he's like, Sheriff Denny Payman is on my side.
Yeah.
You get Sheriff Clark, that's kind of a git.
Yeah.
You know, he's larger-than-life personality.
He's a name.
Wears
he's
a cowboy
draw.
Hat.
Yeah. He's a murderer and a monster and a torturer.
A lot of that didn't happen yet in 2013.
Oh,
but
okay.
Still, fair enough.
I do like how he's still using coded words for black sheriff that he appreciates, where he's like, See, unlike the other, he's smart and well-spoken. And you're like, dude, you know what that means.
Right. He does that a lot.
You have to know.
He does that a lot. And it's one of those things that I just choose to, not point out, because if I did, it would be every single time he talks about any black person. But in this clip, Alex talks more about that, the idea of covering, his own coverage of Sheriff Clark. And I think at the end of this, we really get, an indication of why it's not wise. And this is kind of ironic for me to be saying as someone who spends all his time covering Alex Jones. But I think it's unwise for most people to cover him because of exactly what he expresses at the end of this clip.
Clark told Jones listeners that he would consider any federal order to confiscate guns as an act of tyranny. He also said, I don't want to get shot. He's not stupid. And said that he would refuse to enforce it in the county. You don't like this, do you, that we're now having this discussion, do you? See, we win. We force the initiative. We go on the offense and make you respond to us. You don't control reality anymore, you viper. Let's continue. I believe that if somebody tried to enforce something of that magnitude, you would see the second coming of an American revolution, the likes of which would make the first revolution pale with comparison, the sheriff urged. That comment did not sit well with hacks at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who accused Clark of engaging in attention-grabbing media appearances on a conspiracy-peddling radio show.
The way he's, salaciously reading this, he loves the idea that someone's covering him.
Yeah, he's living in a movie right now.
Right.
He's doing the LaFontaine voice.
Yeah.
You know?
But more importantly is that point that he makes about, like, you hate that we're talking about this and we're controlling the conversation.
Yeah, you're
reporting on us doing something fucked up.
Right.
We're saying fucked up things, and now we're hijacking your cycle.
Right.
And I think that that is the strategy that has been really, really effective.
Oh, yeah.
I think that that is a large part of what makes the media sphere so untenable, and has for a couple years now, at least.
Absolutely.
Is the descending into the mud with these people who are bad faith actors,
right,
who are just trying to either create their own brand, their own popularity, rise their stars.
Right. Doing so
by making sensational, irresponsible, horrible claims that then you cover.
It's literally what happened in 2008 that got us to where we are right now. The birther shit.
Yeah.
Nobody would even have questioned. Nobody would ever have thought about that unless the media took these bullshit bad faith actors who became our fucking president seriously and then repeated their claims.
Yeah.
And now Barack has to address it. And if you never, nobody even wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
You were just being racist.
Yeah.
And that's how we got where we got.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And I know that there is an intrinsic irony, like I said before the clip, about like me pointing this out as we are a Alex Jones podcast.
Right.
But I think that there's a large difference between, especially when we started, didn't expect anybody would like this show.
No, absolutely not.
I think that there's a difference between critical analysis and reporting on dumb bullshit. I hope that there's a difference.
Well, we definitely don't do simply put, the easiest way to differentiate us in this type of coverage is we don't have that 50-50 rule of like, well, if we have somebody on our show who's going to say that obviously the birther conspiracy is racist bullshit,
right,
then we have to have somebody else on our show who's going to say that the racist,
we don't need a
bullshit
Trump surrogate to argue.
We don't bother with that because it's bullshit.
Yeah, that might be a part of it. I'm not entirely sure, but I do have a pretty firm conviction that what Alex is expressing is a clear awareness that the strategy of trying to make people cover his stuff is very effective, and he's very into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's gross. So this brings us to the end of this kind of self-aware episode on the 21st. I have a couple clips from the 22nd, just because I don't want to do it on our next episode. You know, let's just get it out of the way. Because it's trash. It's a really bad episode.
Okay.
A large portion of the episode, he has Ben Fuchs back on the show, who's the pharmacist who works for Youngevity.
Yes.
And they just talk about how, like, you need supplements.
I assume that he definitely pointed out that he works for Youngevity.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but it's basically just an infomercial.
Right.
Like,
gotcha.
They're at least above board about the fact that, like, he works, or he is a spokesperson for their sponsor.
Okay.
But they are still giving out, like, pretty irresponsible advice in many, senses.
Well, you gotta get a sample of the Ebola blood, otherwise the supplements aren't going to work,
Dan.
It's
not that irresponsible.
Oh, okay, well, that's good.
Still, like, get off your meds kind of shit.
Gotcha.
So, like, ugh. The only other thing that happens that I think is hilarious is that Alex is on a big narrative of the military or the government has sent, veterans, a lot of mail, like a bulk mailing to all the veterans that, they need to turn in their guns. And Alex takes calls from veterans, and none of them have received this mail. Like, it keeps...
But they're all talking like they have? Or,
well,
like, they heard a guy...
Alex does not take the fact that all of them have not received a letter as any kind of problem for his narrative.
Right.
And because they're Alex Jones fans, they make excuses. Like, I haven't checked the mail.
I don't know.
Look, I haven't gotten it, but it's possible it exists.
Right. I heard from one of my guys that he knew a guy who got the mail.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a sad display of an episode. It's not very good. We'll play this one clip where Alex explains that, like, so even if you're in the fucking CIA, you don't know what Alex knows because the CIA is compartmentalized. So you know what your world is doing.
Right.
But then there's other people over here who decompartmentalized in another section. They know.
Right.
This person, you know X. This person over here, they know Y. This other person, they know W.
But Alex knows the gestalt.
He knows the alphabet.
He's got the whole thing.
Because he's decompartmentalized. And what he's doing is decompartmentalizing all the information he knows. So if you know X, now you know Y also.
Right.
And
I don't believe him.
No. Certainly not. But he then explains how he knows the entire game plan.
I'm decompartmentalizing this for you. I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been obsessed with this, dreaming about it at night for 17. I know the whole game plan. I know it better than the people at the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, because 99% of them are compartmentalized. There are very few people, even in the power structure, that know how this whole thing's meant to go down. It's so complex, I can't even articulate it to you. Okay? I'm not bragging about this. I know the whole plan, because I've probably read 30 books on the Soviets. I probably read 10 books on the pre-Soviet era. I probably read 15 books on the Czars. I probably read 100 books on the Nazis. I probably read 50 books on the Vatican. I've read 25 or more books on British history, on Roman history, on African history. I've read probably over 1,000 history books on these subjects, and I know what the globalists are doing and how they've integrated all these systems of control.
At least two of those books about the Vatican were written by Leo Zagami,
yeah.
So I'm going to deduct those from your... that gives you some indication of, like,
Alex,
what books you might be reading.
Why are you reading so many books about Nazis?
It is a lot.
It seems like you read a lot of books about Nazis.
And who's writing those books?
It doesn't...
Who's writing those books? What kind of perspective are you getting on the Nazis from those books? The other thing I would say is, like, so my dad is a professor, and I grew up in close proximity with a lot of professors and academics and scholars. People who dedicate their lives to studying various topics and helping teach people about those topics. And one thing that I know is a hallmark of every good academic is rattling off how many books about a certain subject they've
read. I'm pretty sure that's what academics do all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because it's super not infuriating in a conversation where you're talking about something, and instead of, you know, engaging with somebody's argument, you say, No. I've read more books about this than you.
I know everything more than people who are in the CIA, and it's too complicated for me to even express to you. Now let me tell you how many books I've read.
Yes. Yeah.
Great.
That clip is definitely, like, regardless of whether he believes it or is acting or not.
Yeah.
That clip is like, you need to see a psychiatrist.
It's disrespectful to, like, knowing things.
Humans.
Like, just the very idea of knowledge.
Yeah.
It's disrespectful to.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Gutenberg just shit himself. That's what happened.
Yeah. Like, I can't imagine somebody who actually cares about subjects being like that, acting that way.
No.
And that's not the first time we've heard Alex rattle off how many goddamn books he's read about various subjects. It's an appeal to something that's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because you could have read 10 books about a certain subject and know nothing about it.
Mm.
You could have read horrible books, or your ability to internalize information could be below average.
Yeah.
Like, you could have not synthesized the information from those books. You may have technically read. You could come away with it with no expanded knowledge base.
Right.
You could know nothing. What he's saying is just some appeal to, like, if you don't know that this doesn't mean anything, you'd be like, oh, Alex is real smart. He's read a bunch of books.
Mm.
Like, that's all he's doing. He's trying to impress people who don't understand that he doesn't know anything.
Yeah. That's
it's frustrating.
That's like the literal interpretation of the Tao. Like, that is, like, one who speaks does not know is right in that wheelhouse. That's exactly what Lao Tzu is trying to express.
Yeah. One who yells about how many books they've read has not internalized the information
exactly.
from those books.
If you are mistaking quantity of books with quality of information, then you're fucked.
Yeah. And we have one last clip here, and this is from when Alex is talking about talking to the longevity pharmacist, Fuchs. Some people might accuse this of being somehow body shaming, and I don't mean it to be at all. It's just I'm interested in the relative size of Alex's neck throughout his career. And in this clip.
That is the neck version of Plant Watch.
Yes.
That is not body shaming.
It's
that
not.
That is fascination with
I'm not
with
saying
nature.
That there's anything good or bad, unappealing or appealing about a smaller or larger neck, and I'm not trying to make Alex feel bad at all. He talks about his neck a lot.
It's true.
And that's why it's interesting to me to find that in 2013, his neck was shrinking.
My neck, my face, my arms, my legs have all gotten smaller, but I don't follow the whole InfoWarsHealth.com longevity program. I'm trying to. My belly has stayed the same size. And a lot of evidence is I guess I'm still eating gluten, and I guess I've got the wheat belly.
He's got the wheat belly.
What?
Apparently he is bad with bread. Bad with gluten.
He's got the wheat belly. Is
yeah.
that a thing people say?
I've not heard it before.
I've never heard anyone say, oh, I got a touch of the wheat belly.
I've not heard that formulation of gluten intolerance, but... I don't know if this is still something he has, like a intolerance to gluten.
Mm.
I'm not sure. This is the first time I've ever heard him bring that up. It's also relevant in terms of like not just making fun of his neck or anything like that, but because it's within the context of almost a testimonial for his supplements.
Yeah.
Like I've been taking these. I haven't taken them all, but I've been getting back on the InfoWars life. Products and all my arms and neck have been shrinking,
mm.
been getting smaller. That's, you know, he's indicating that he's losing weight from
yeah.
these, so sometime in between 2013 and the present, perhaps when he stopped taking longevity products, his neck, got freakishly large as he has, to quote him, his
yeah.
own description.
Yeah.
Freakishly large neck.
I think it's almost a refreshing testimonial. Like, I would prefer that to any, actual, like, if you do all the InfoWars light stuff, you'll be able to get better and be fit. He's more or less just like, look, I'm lazy like you. I'm trying. It's mm-hmm. getting a little bit better. I'm not perfect. Maybe you should buy it. Why are you making me feel bad? Like,
there
he's defensively telling you.
There's an ambivalence to the salesmanship almost.
Yeah.
Or at least like it's grounded more than a lot
yeah.
of other ones in the sense that it's like, if he was trying to just, like, be completely crass,
mm-hmm.
he would just be like, he wouldn't bring up his belly.
Yeah, his wheat belly.
He wouldn't. Although, I don't know if it would be wise of him to say that their products could treat gluten intolerance.
Ooh.
So maybe that is sort of a dodge. I don't know. At least you would expect he would be going over the top, though,
yeah.
and not bringing up things
yeah.
that haven't been helped.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know.
Or his own inadequacy. And, you know, he's not following the entire regimen, even though he's telling you how great it will be.
I honestly actually think that that is just his way around, like arguments that's like, well, why are you unhealthy if you take all of your health supplements?
Right, right.
He consistently is never on all of them.
Right.
Or that is something I've always heard him say, even when Dr. DeGroop comes along.
Mm-hmm.
Is like the, I mean to take all, I just kind of forget sometimes. And that way he can't be living proof that his shit doesn't work.
That's true. That's a really good point. Yeah. I did not consider that it's kind of a brilliant dodge. Yeah, yeah, a little bit.
But I think compared to the present day, you see a bit less of like a really over the top salesmanship. Yeah. And I think probably part of that might be indicative of him not getting a huge cut of the sales.
Yeah.
You might not have as big an interest in moving this product than he does in the present.
That's probably true.
So we've reached the end here, and I think that this is a bit of a, you know, I think Alex is right when he started the first episode on the 21st that he needs to mix things up.
Mm-hmm.
He is in a bit of a rut. There is a little bit of staleness to his show in 2013. You know, still not really talking much about Sandy Hook here at this point. And I wonder if those two things are going to join together.
The
desire
jolt?
To mix things up. Is it possible that maybe being really fucking irresponsible in his reporting about dumbass conspiracy theories that he's already sort of danced around and dipped his toe into a little bit, is that going to be what he decides to do to mix things up?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Maybe he feels real bad about shutting that guy down and poo-pooing his ideas.
The non-scientific guy?
Yeah, he's going to think about it and he's going to say, you know what? Maybe I should be less scientific too. I'm going to, and then here we are.
I don't know. It's interesting. I'm very interested. If only because I like to take a man at his word. And if Alex is telling me he intends to mix things up, it makes me think that maybe at least something will get exciting.
Yeah.
In this 2013 stretch. So I'm very excited to see what happens. And especially because I'm not super excited about the present day. Like, I don't really care about Alex's feelings about the Trump having his social media summit. I don't particularly care about a ton of that. So the idea that maybe we're cooking up a little bit here in the past is much needed.
Yeah, I'd prefer that.
Yeah. So we'll be back next week. But until then, Jordan, we have a website.
We do have a website. It's knowledgefight.com.
You bet it is. We're also on Twitter.
We are. It's at @knowledge_fight and @GoToBedJordan.
Yeah, we're also on Facebook.
We are. And you know where you could download our show if you would like to?
What is that?
You could go to iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
You could go to your local co-op.
Mm-hmm.
Many people get together at skateboard shops. You get an episode of our podcast with every skateboard you purchase.
But not if you just get trucks.
Oh, absolutely. Well, why would you even want an episode of ours if you're only getting trucks? We don't want you.
No.
That's the rule.
So you can do all that stuff.
Yeah.
As we get to the end of this, I think I have no evidence that the caller who put rainwater in his fridge killed anybody. I don't know, but I have no evidence of it.
You put a drop of water in the fridge. It's only a couple of years before you got a human body in there, Dan.
You know what? I can't prove you wrong.
Slippery slope.
But we don't have no evidence of that. But one guy who technically probably has killed somebody is Alex Jones.
Andy in Kansas, you're on the air. Thanks for holding.
Hello, Alex. I'm a first time caller. I'm a huge fan. I love your work.
I love you.